Studios at Universal Orlando Resort.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Smart Clock Podcast is back once again.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special report.
Finally, The Rock has come back to Washington, D.C.
Welcome to WCW Monday Nitro. We're on the air for three.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to a very special Manic Mondays. Steve Neal has been on holiday over the previous week, so this is a special pre-recorded Manic Mondays, a 9/11 tribute, so to speak, as it is going out on 9/11. And joining me, as ever, is Steve Neal himself to run down this very special episode of Manic Mondays.
Hello, mate. How are you? Good?
Yes, not too bad, mate. Congratulations on the new house, sir. Hopefully you'll getting close to moving it. You'll be very close to moving in, actually, when the listeners digest this wonderful episode.
Yes, end of this week, actually. While they're sitting and listening, I shall be preparing very much to get moving. But yes, we are going to be chatting about the kind of the impact, I guess, of 9/11 on the WWE, and particularly the SmackDown that followed 9/11. But we will try and lighten it up in the second half of the show, as always, with some mid-carders of the week and matches of the week as well, as per usual.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. So be sure to send your well wishes and love to Steve on his move, and congratulations on his brand new move and the ownership of a new house. But let's get cracking with this very unique and quite... Well, I mean, I wouldn't like to use the word morbid, but a very somber tone, I suppose, in 9/11. Mm-hmm. Obviously, everyone's aware of what 9/11 is. We don't need to run that down for you or remind you. But obviously, it's one of the most tragic days in world history, never mind American history. And WWE, or WWF as it was at the time, decided to use SmackDown as a platform to entertain and lighten the hearts of America, live from Texas itself, the Lone Star State. Very much one of the major hearts of the United States is Texas. It's considered almost a country within itself, and they decided to televise SmackDown live as well, which at the time was quite a big deal. It was always taped on a Tuesday, of course, 9/11, the tragedy of which had happened, I believe, on the Tuesday. So the next day, this was recorded live and televised to the world. And essentially, this was WWF's call to arms to say, we are not going to bow down to the fear that terrorism induces in our country and across the world. We are going to give our audience what they want most, and that is entertainment, and just try and take their minds off of things. So at the time, of course, the Alliance angle was in full swing. This was still there to a small extent, but obviously this was a much more watered down, family-friendly episode, so that everyone could just, you know, come out, have a good time, and try and take that first step towards rebuilding in the aftermath of what was a tragic event. So, obviously, myself and Steve have rewatched it many times over the years, and here we are to give you our opinions, thoughts, and just an emotional context of what it meant to be involved in such a moment. So, take it away, buddy.
Yeah, I mean, the wrestling and the booking and what matches there are were kind of irrelevant. You know, the majority of the matches were kind of short, and that really wasn't the focus and the emphasis of the show going in. Obviously, there was a lot of questions to be asked about whether to do the show in the first place. They were already in Texas when 9/11 happened, as Amir says, ready to record on that day, which obviously they decided was impossible to do. So there was a lot of meetings that went on over the next 2 days before they decided to broadcast live in their normal Thursday night spot that the recorded show would have gone out on. So there was a lot of meetings between Vince and the mayor of Dallas, is it, that they're in, it's the Compaq Center where they do it, and to decide whether the show is going to go ahead. And ultimately they decide that's what has to happen. The president at the time of America was George W. Bush, and he'd already kind of given a speech of America we need to get back to work. We need to get back on our feet. We need to show them that we're going to return to normality as much as is possible to prove that terrorism can't win. And Vince kind of decided, well, then let's get back to work. And our work is entertaining the American people. And this is our first opportunity to do that. And it was the biggest gathering of its kind that wasn't, you know, in grief or in rescue efforts since the tragedy happened. And it's quite spectacular to think of, really, that all these names were there, you know, Stone Cold, The Rock, you know, everyone that you would expect to be there. Obviously, you know, Vince and Stephanie and Paul Heyman and Jericho, Edge and Christian, they're all there. And it's very akin to the format of the Owen Hart tribute show, if you go back and have watched that episode of Raw, where they intersperse, you know, very short, sharp matches, which don't, you know, although the booking is very much, you know, WWF versus the Alliance, it's not really about who wins or who loses. It's not really relevant to any storylines continuing to be explored. You know, the big rivalry and feud they had going on at the time was Kurt Angle of Team WWF and Stone Cold, who was a WWF champion in the Alliance, and building towards their feud and their title match that was coming up at Unforgiven, I believe, a few weeks down the line. Well, they did nothing to talk about that feud. They did nothing to build that feud. There was no promos or segments towards it. There was no match between the two or stare down or any of the normal shenanigans that you would expect. Kurt Angle did wrestle. He did have a match to close out the show, and that was the only time that the USA chant is acceptable, quite frankly, and cracked out, you know, literally whipped it as the show goes off air. It's Kurt Angle leading the Compact Center in a rich USA chant, which was a very emotionally powerful moment. The show is, as I say, matches interspersed with backstage interviews with the superstars, you know, even a couple of backstage hands and writers and ex-pros who are back there as well, talking about kind of their feelings. And it is very emotionally powerful to hear someone like Lance Storm, for instance, say, "I'm not American. I don't live in America. But I feel attacked. This doesn't just affect America and America's people. This is an attack on the world. When I get on a plane to fly to a show, my wife and son are scared of what's going to happen to me. And while I'm away from them so that I can come and entertain you, I am afraid for my wife and son." Taz comes on, you know, obviously very proud New Yorker himself, saying, my wife and son are terrified at home. There's all these continuing bomb scares and bomb threats and hoaxes that are going on back there. There's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of anxiety in the air. We don't really know what's happening. We're still not sure directly who is responsible for the attack in the first place. We don't know if there's going to be more. We don't know if there are any other targets and what those targets may be. We have to assume the worst. And I can't be with them to comfort them right now, which is where I should be. I'm here because I need to come out here and do my job and do what's better for, you know, the country. You had Lillian Garcia give an interview where she said, "I live in New York. My family and friends are in New York. I haven't heard from some of my friends now 2 days on to know if they're okay. I don't know what's going on. I know that I had one friend who's alive who missed his 8:30 meeting in the Twin Towers on September the 11th. And he survived through sheer luck. And I'm relieved and overjoyed by that. And at the same time, you know, obviously feel a bit guilty for being happy that someone's alive and so many are dead." And it was kind of that fear and uncertainty that she encapsulated so brilliantly. The show opens with Vince cutting almost a promo, really, against terrorists in a lot of ways. But it was a stirring speech. I mean, it was almost a presidential speech. You could certainly see Vince McMahon, the man. You can see why he's been such a success in business and in family with the way that he stirred that crowd and he roused America. I mean, he was, to be fair, as the leader of Team WWF, in a rare stint as a babyface in his kind of on-screen career to this point. But this wasn't about heels and faces. This was just a very, very proud and very patriotic American person going out into in front of, I think, 13,500 people, sell out. And before there had been any credits, just speaking to the nation and taking advantage of this massive platform that he had been afforded and wanting to use it in a way which was very responsible. And he did that. He did that very, very well. We then get the credits. Obviously, we don't get pyros. That would have been in quite horrific taste, even for Vince. And everyone from backstage, whether they were wrestlers, you know, some of the writers and creative team as well, basically anyone who could, who wasn't needed to keep the show on air at the time, you know, the camera operators and directors and lighting guys, came out onto the stage and down the ramp towards the ring. Whether they were Alliance or WWF, all standing together side by side, many of them carrying little American flags, even people like Edge, who of course is Canadian, still carrying that American flag to show solidarity. Obviously, there are a number of Texans there, people like Bradshaw and people like Stone Cold and Deborah and people like that were all out there as well. But at the front and center was the leader of Team WWF and the biggest face and biggest name in the company at that point, The Rock, alongside Vince McMahon. And they came down and introduced by the Fink, Howard Finkel, the main ring announcer at the during the Attitude Era. Lillian Garcia was introduced. Now, she'd only come into the company at the back end of 1999, so she'd been there less than 2 years. And all of a sudden, she's on this platform as someone who's still wondering if family and friends are alive or dead, thousands of miles away back in her home city of New York after a devastating terrorist attack on live national and international TV in the first broadcast of its type since a tragedy 48 hours earlier, being asked to sing the national anthem, the most patriotic song, the most patriotic piece of music for any country. And she performs it beautifully. There is, you know, you can hear the emotion and the sadness in her voice throughout, but it is still, she's got an incredible singing voice, Lillian Garcia. And it's a beautiful and moving moment. You know, I feel emotional thinking about it now, and I'm not American, but it is an incredible moment. At the time, I remember, obviously, I didn't see it live myself. I saw it a day or two later, but you know, I cried then. You know, it was such a terrifying time for people all around the world, you know, not just in America, but all around the world, to think that America and New York, such a infamous, incredible and immortal place, landscape, you know, a symbol for the world, could have been attacked in this manner, made everyone feel afraid. If you can get to New York, you can get to anywhere. That was the message, and that was why everyone was afraid. And to hear the defiance, as well as the sadness, as well as the fear, the defiance in the voices of so many of those superstars who did backstage interviews, but also in Lillian Garcia as she sung that national anthem, was really inspirational and really inspiring to a huge number of people all around the world who were watching it and have watched it since. And, you know, there were wrestlers, some of whom were openly crying, some of whom were just trying to hold it together and do almost an English stiff upper lip, you know, but you could see the emotion racked across their face. This wasn't about entertainment. This was about solidarity and unity. And it's a really beautiful moment. And then JR just, you know, they go into an advert break and, you know, look, we'll be back to entertain you and try and be as business as normal as we can after the break. And it's sometimes Vince and the WWE, WWF, as it was then, get things tonally perfect. Frequently, they fuck it up entirely. For any more information on that, tune in to Week in the Universe, Jinder Mahal versus Charlottesville. But on this occasion, they get it absolutely perfect, as they did with the Owen Hart tribute show. And the other thing that this shows is a huge amount of sports were cancelled that week in America. You know, you didn't have NFL. There were no NFL matches the following, you know, weekend, maybe even couple of weeks. But the WWE isn't a sport in its, you know, it isn't exclusively a sport. It's sports entertainment. And that entertainment part means the show must go on. And you ask the countless superstars who have wrestled through injury and wrestled through pain and wrestled through personal tragedy, people like Eddie Guerrero, people like Mick Foley, who's wrestled as his ear came off, has wrestled after being unconscious. You ask The Undertaker, who's wrestled after being accidentally set on fire three times before he's even got to the ring. Nope, you've got to have a match now. The show must go on. You ask all of them. The show went on when Owen Hart died in the middle of the ring during a live pay-per-view. They wrestled after that. They put on a show when one of their best friends had died. And this showed the same mentality. It was controversial. There was criticism for it as much as praise. But I've always been staunchly in the praise camp for the courage that it took, for the strength that it took for people who were thousands of miles away from home and their families and their friends and the people they loved to put on a show for the good of America. Not for the good of themselves. For the good of themselves would be to go home. This wasn't a show they were going to make money off of. So this wasn't Vince doing it for corporate greed. This is a good thing to do for the country. This is the right thing to do. This is the stance to take. And it was they were absolutely correct and justified in doing that in the years that followed. Now, there were a lot of things that came out, followed on from 9/11 in terms of the storylines. And so there are a number of memorable ones that I'm sure we'll talk about more. But certainly there was the terrorism angle with Mohammed Hassan and The Undertaker. I mean, even now with ISIS running about over the last few years, it would be horrifically uncomfortable doing it now. And they did it in, 2004, 2005?
Yeah.
The height of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it was actually 4 days they broadcast this, recorded this, 4 days before the 7/7 attacks on the London transport system, on the tube and underground and bus network of London. So in the UK, we said, we're not going to broadcast this. We've actually just suffered a legitimate terror attack. And there were a lot of countries around the world who said, no, this is hugely in poor taste. There was a lot of pressure from networks in America to say, we want this edited out of the show. And Vince said, I'm not editing it. You can edit it out of the show. You can censor it, but I'm not editing it. I'm Vince McMahon, damn it. And so to get around the censorship, so people in countries where it had been censored and taken out of the programming for, you know, common human decency, he put it online on the website where he couldn't be censored.
Bloody
so man. That anyone could watch it if they chose to. And this was basically Mohammed Hassan and Daivari and four masked Arab men with clubs and a piano wire mercilessly beating The Undertaker in the middle of the ring and choking him out with piano wire in a very Taliban-esque attack. It was very visually impactful and in awful taste. And the timing could not have been worse with the events that followed. Now, obviously, Vince couldn't foresee that, but he knew the climate that we were living in at the time when Al-Qaeda were attacking people at random. Now, this was it must be 2005 then, if it was during the London bombs. And that's 2 years after the Madrid bombings in Spain. This was 2 years after the Al-Qaeda deadly terrorist attacks at a hotel in Bali. This isn't something that was just happening in countries that don't watch WWE. You know, this was happening in big markets for the WWE, even back then in the mid-noughties. But even closer to the time, obviously a lot of patriotism had to come out of it. But he used things like the Un-Americans with Christian and Test and Lance Storm, I think, was in it at that point as well. The Un-Americans as a faction. And he was using divisive creative and rhetoric on the show within months. I think the Un-Americans debuted 8 or 9 months after 9/11.
Yeah, they also tried to burn the American flag live on Raw.
They did, and this was basically all to, we know what a whip-up hate, anyone who says they hate America, at this point where everyone is very, very raw. I mean, people are still raw about 9/11, and it's been 16 years. And understandably so. It's something that people are never going to fully get over who lived through that traumatic time. But this is like 9 months later. You know, now we can sit there and say this beautiful new building has been erected on the place on Ground Zero. It has been, they've been replaced, they've been honoured and commemorated in a fitting way. And there's the defiance of saying we're going to build an even taller building, motherfuckers. At the time, the rubble wasn't cleared and they were starting to produce heels purely on the basis of we're not Americans and we hate America. And it was dangerous. Some will say, you know, it's brave. Some will say it's genius. I don't know. I thought it was a little bit uncomfortable and insensitive. There are ways of making great heels where they don't have to hate America. You know, I don't remember one great Triple H heel promo or Vince heel promo or Rock heel promo, whoever, where they say, I hate America and that's why you should hate me. You know, there's a laziness to it. And at the time, I felt it was dangerous and not edgy, but just dangerous. But they also put the title on Kurt Angle at Unforgiven, you know, a few weeks after 9/11. You know, American gold medalist, American hero, huge babyface at the time, one of the real leaders in Team WWF, beating that dastardly heel Stone Cold Steve Austin and bringing the WWF title back home to the WWF. So both of the world titles resided, albeit briefly, I think for about 2 weeks, in the WWF. And it was just, they produced that feel-good moment that the country needed at the time as they were still grieving just a matter of weeks after 9/11. So that was brilliant creative and brilliant decisions, which I think were changed from the original idea in the wake of 9/11. That's Vince and the creative team of WWF doing brilliant stuff. But some of the things that came afterwards were just shocking, really. But the SmackDown afterwards is something to go back and watch, not for great wrestling content or storylines or drama or great comedy, you know, funny promos or anything like that, but just for very, very powerful emotion and to see that every now and then the WWF, WWE steps up and produces moments of real credibility, real integrity, and an emotional reflection that encapsulates the mood of a country and says, we are standing alongside you. We are standing with you. We feel every single inch of your pain. And we're going to give you the defiance that, you know, the great baby faces of the WWE have had over the years. You know, people like Stone Cold. No matter what you do to me, I am not going to lay down. I'm going to get back up and give you a fuck you. Right up to the John Cena's and the Roman Reigns of today. The Daniel Bryan's, the CM Punk's in fighting against the authority and those threats. This was Vince and the WWE doing exactly that. We will not lay down. We will embody everything that the American people, particularly in Texas, are going to want to say to anyone who wants to damage American values and human values. And there were some really, really nice vignettes in there to go and watch, you know, from people like Lita, people like Jericho. You know, it's probably the best moment of talking that I've seen from Bradshaw, other than the fact that he says how much he loves George W. Bush, which makes him a huge penis. But it was, you know, even Farouk, Ron Simmons, known mostly for saying one word for a lot of fans out there, you know, just speaking from the heart as a proud American. You know, it's William Regal's on there as well. You know, The Rock's on there being very emotional. It's a guy who wants to be president. I'm sure he can crack that video out at some point to try and get him some votes. You know, Austin's on there and it's people speaking as themselves. They're not in character. You know, it's not The Rock says. It's Dwayne Johnson. You know, Edge, straight away at the beginning of his, one of the first ones, if not the first vignette that we see of the night, is him saying, I don't know how much Edge can comfort you. And I certainly don't know if you care what Adam Copeland has to say. And he's saying, look, this is me. This is me being Adam Copeland, a man, a person, a human being. I'm not here to be a wrestling persona, a performer, an actor, a character. I'm just here to speak to you. And I think the one that got me the most was Stacey Keibler. Not because she is in any way some great talker or some inspirational mind, but because she's 21 years of age at that point. She's a young, young woman. She's barely of legal age to consume alcohol. And she's being put in a position where not only has she to come out 2 days after this attack has happened, while a national anthem is being sung, and weep in front of the nation quite openly. Not only is she, you know, coming out and escorting people to the ring, maybe Chris Candido or someone like that to the ring, standing around the outside and doing her job and having to get on with her job as normal. But she has to do this vignette where she speaks to the country at 21 years of age. And I thought that was just a really huge responsibility. And I don't think that Vince or anyone behind the scenes forced people to go on, because not every superstar, you know, did one or certainly had one broadcast. I think it was people who said, actually, you know, I'll say something. I'll step up. I'll say something. And for her to have done that and put herself in that position shows an incredible class and, you know, shows her as a person. We don't always look back on her fondly because she was kind of a lot of comedy bullshit. You know, she couldn't wrestle. She was there because she was an incredibly stunning woman to be basically in lingerie matches and to be objectified and be a sexual object. But in that moment, she was just a young woman, a young girl coming out and speaking very emotionally in the aftermath of one of the greatest tragedies, if not the greatest tragedy, in terms of an attack and huge loss of life that has ever happened in the history of the United States of America, and one of the worst that we've seen around the world. So, you know, I wanted to pay tribute to her, really.
And it's a perfect eulogy, really, to the remembrance of what tragically happened, and also a celebration of what WWF does best on its days after. I'm glad you mentioned the other side of things as well, the contentious angles that we use down the line, because we shouldn't forget that despite the fact this was a special moment, there's also a tremendous amount of idiocy that comes from WWE, and also from us to a certain extent, from watching it and consuming it and trying to understand and tolerate certain things that are inflammatory. And it's a wonderful, wonderful moment. And I, you know, in no way do I mean to denigrate such a moment. But at the same time, it's important that we have a balance of understanding from both sides. We shouldn't just, you know, celebrate WWF and then just ignore the fact that they have had some flagrantly unacceptable moments, you know, particularly in relation to such a touchy subject, which is the violence and terrorism of this world, even to this day with what's going on. So, you know, it's, yeah, I don't know. I guess to understand happiness, you also have to understand pain, is what I've always been told as a young kid and growing up through life, is that if you don't see both sides of the spectrum, then how are you to truly understand what's right and wrong? So I appreciate the fact that it wasn't all just sunshine and lollipops. Not too much I can really add to it. There is a couple of takeaways from this. One, of course, is the main event, which is Kurt Angle, the American Hero versus Rhino. It is actually a really, really good crisp match between a massively underrated wrestler in Rhino and, of course, you know, Kurt Angle in his absolute prime. If nothing else, this match really does highlight the complete package that was Kurt Angle as the wrestler, but it also highlighted the fact that he could channel his character into something important when he needed to. It wasn't just a facade. It wasn't just, hey, look at my fancy American flags, look at my gold medal. He was a legitimate patriot, a man who loved his country, a native son of Pittsburgh. And I loved it when he gets on the mic at the end and he's just shouting USA down the mic. He's visibly emotional. They keep looking at, obviously, the United States serviceman, the man who served in Vietnam, who's sitting in the front row, and he's chanting USA. The crowd is emotional. People are crying. People are chanting. People are cheering. This was a moment for WWF to say to their audience and to anyone who was willing to, you know, accept that they had done this show and who was willing to sit down and enjoy the product, maybe for the first time, or maybe with people that they don't necessarily watch with. I'm sure there are a lot of people who thought, oh, my kids watch wrestling, but, you know, it's an important time that we all stay together and we show humility and strength as a unit, so I'll sit down and watch wrestling with them. And this would have been a great example of what wrestling can do for the younger generation. This would have taught a wonderful lesson to younger fans especially, and to people who maybe didn't appreciate wrestling just for the art it was, because it was still, you know, enjoying the boom, the successful period that was the Attitude Era. We'd just come out of the WrestleMania 17 boom, still a lot of viewers hanging around, watching, really enjoying what was the pinnacle of sports entertainment, as Vince McMahon would like to say. And this was the opportunity to teach people that, yeah, wrestling's a bit carny sometimes. Yeah, we're stupid and we do offensive stuff and we do hardcore stuff. But this was pure entertainment. This was like taking your family to the cinema or to the local circus when they're in town and just having a good time and remembering what it's like to be a human being. And that's encapsulated in the way all the wrestlers perform on this show. You know, things like the Hardy Boys, you know, Spike Dudley's out there. There's a uniqueness. I never thought I'd see a tag team of Tajiri, Scotty Too Hotty, and William Regal. It's like the most, it's just strange to see, but it also encapsulated what this was about. This was about, we don't care about angles tonight. We don't care about rivalries and stuff like that. I appreciate the fact that they kept the alliance angle, but all the alliance and WWE stars, they stood at the ramp and they, you know, they maintained the reality and the poignancy of the moment. They didn't try and be clever or, you know, put the WCW stars on one side of the ramp, WWF guys on the other. And it's very, very special when you see someone who is as big as The Rock, who is now, let's be frank, one of the biggest movie stars in the world, if not the biggest, most definitely the biggest action star in the world. And he's standing there front and center, somber, calm, disposition from his character of The Rock, the Great One, but still with the presence. And he is just Dwayne Johnson standing there. There's Kurt Angle just standing there as an American singing the national anthem. There are people like Arn Anderson out there who had just come from the WCW. You know, when WCW had been bought out, you know, those guys had been at WCW, so they're not really that well ingratiated into the WWE locker room and the system yet. And they're out there. These great icons. Austin's at the back. You know, you've got the Big Show. All these people that you sort of take for granted nowadays and just say, yeah, no, these people that are just part of wrestling folklore, and they're all out there as human beings to pay respect. And you mentioned Lillian Garcia. It's one of the best and most powerful versions of the American National Anthem I've ever heard. A lot of times when we listen to it, particularly at things like the Super Bowl, artists try and put their own spin on it. They try and make it about themselves in a way. This was very much about expressing her emotion for a country she loved. And that is what the national anthem in any country is supposed to be about, expressing your love and your desire to support your nation, your patriotism, your pride in your people, your country, and everything that comes with it, the freedoms that you get to enjoy on a regular basis that people fought for. And for her to deliver such a beautifully powerful, eloquent, and simplistic national anthem was an absolute credit to her, especially, as you mentioned, the fact that she'd been there less than 2 years. And, you know, you mentioned Stacey Keibler. It was wonderful. There was a lot of young wrestlers actually on here, you know, who were asked to, you know, let's be honest, it's not a chore. So when I say they were asked to go out there and, you know, present themselves, stand up and have something to say, it shouldn't really be a daunting feat, so to speak. But you understand what I mean. Like, you know, at that age, like you say with Stacey Keibler, it's incredibly difficult to speak to a national audience. You know, they were garnering 6 or 7 million viewers a week at times. And to sit there and speak on behalf of a company, which, let's be honest, is going to be very quick to slaughter you should you make a mistake. Even JBL, I wasn't the biggest fan of his America fuck yeah speech, in the sense of, you know, when you look back at what's gone on and what obviously came after these events. But at the time, he was a very proud American. He was very passionate. And his speech did sum up what America is all about. It's about that fire. You get that sense when you go there yourself and you visit. For anyone who hasn't, but is keen on it, I highly recommend it. It's such a unique level of patriotism that you don't find anywhere else in the world. Most people, to an extent, are proud of where they live and their country. But in America, it's a freedom. It's the Constitution. It's the Second Amendment. All of these things play into it. Everything about America, their entire culture, is built around the premise of being proud of being American. Even immigration, which frankly built that wonderful country, despite, you know, the misery and the turmoil that it's suffering right now. Whenever you think of America, you think of, you know, the gunships, you think of the overflying aircrafts, you think of the glorious banner, the stars and stripes. You think about the vehement passion for a country, the willingness to fight more than most. And this was all encapsulated beautifully in Vince McMahon's speech, the show, the way they wrestled, the way they were like, we will not bow down to anything. And yeah, you mentioned 7-7, that helped rally Britain, particularly England. And there are numerous terrorist attacks. It's quite sad to say that in this day and age, we have terrorist attacks, it seems, on a weekly basis now. Terror is very much one of the biggest parts of our lives now. It's a facet of life that we are having to cope with. We're having to fight on a daily basis. We're having to accept just almost as part of the norm. And that is the biggest tragedy of terrorism, is that it has become the norm of our cultures as human beings overall, not just white people, not just black people, not just certain countries, everybody across the world. This is the problem when people don't unite and they don't show love for each other. You allow things like terror to breed and to spread. And that's what's happening, because we as a people don't love enough. We don't fight together as a unit enough. We're still too busy, you know, chasing down elements of greed, political power, you know, these things, these stupid moments in life, these cultures, these levels of pride that frankly should pale in comparison to acts of terror, but they don't. Some people still care more about that than they do anything else. That's one of many reasons why terror continues to spread. So it's lovely to watch something like this, where just for once, everybody in unity just holds hands and takes a moment to essentially say, fuck you, terrorism. Fuck you, the people who are trying to break us down. We will not be pushed into a corner. We will continue to enjoy what we love most. And WWF superstars will continue to do what they do best, which is entertain the masses. So that is very much my takeaway of it, is the fact that America, in all its glory and all its understanding and all the explosions and the star-spangled banners, all encapsulated for one night under the WWF regime, so to speak. So that's kind of our overall encompassing view on the thoughts of 9/11 and obviously the WWF's reaction to 9/11. Let us know what you think, obviously, on the usual social media platforms. But I think it's time to lighten it up slightly with some mid-carders of the week. So, Steve, give us your mid-carder of the week.
Well, I think after that, it's important to try and make people feel a little bit better. And so, possibly to give someone that people can go back and watch and hopefully laugh. And who better to laugh at than a clown? That's right. Doink the Clown is my mid-carder of
the week. Fantastic.
And Doink the Clown, who's actually played by 8 different people through the years. He's predominantly played and originally played by a guy called Matthew Osborne. He passed away, but he was actually fired from the WWF for a number of drug-related offences. So there was also Steve Cairn, Steve Lombardi, John Maloff, Ray Apollo, and Nick Dinsmore were the other people who played Doink the Clown through the years. Oh, yes. And he did that most recently as part of... Oh, my God, my phone's going. Oops. Sorry, everyone. And actually, so Nick Dinsmore, obviously Eugene, as you say, Nick Dinsmore, he had that match, or was, I think it was in 2003. It was the first time that he played Doink the Clown. And that was losing to, of all people, Chris Benoit. So, but he also appeared at Raw 1000 as well. And I think he had a match with, I think maybe 2007, Saturday night's main event. He had a match at that point. I think he was beaten by Great Khali, which, yeah, sums that up. But during Doink's original run, he used to play pranks on people. That was kind of part of his gimmick. So he started off playing pranks kind of either on members of the audience or superstars. This was back in 1992. He didn't have his first match till 93. And he was, I remember him using a tripwire on the Big Boss Man and, you know, dumping water on Marty Jannetty and people like that. He actually had essentially at first a bit of a partnership or a friendship with Jerry the King Lawler. And he actually offered to take the place from Jerry Lawler, who, being the dastardly heel, faked an injury so he didn't have to face Bret the Hitman Hart. So Doink the Clown had a match with Bret the Hitman Hart at SummerSlam 1993, if you can possibly believe that, before he started feuding with Jerry the King Lawler. This feud actually won an award in Wrestling Observer News as the worst feud of 1994. He was voted as the worst wrestler in 1994 and was the worst match of 1994. I have to read this out because it's absolutely incredible. Was Doink the Clown teaming with Dink, Pink and Wink versus Jerry Lawler teaming with Sleazy, Queasy and Cheesy at Survivor Series 1994. Catch that on the network, folks. He created the feud with Jerry Lawler by coming down interrupting one of Jerry Lawler's segments. I think this was a like wrestling challenge, I think it was called, back in 94. And basically making a bunch of jokes about Jerry the King Lawler being the Burger King and a bunch of Burger King references before tipping a bucket of water over Jerry Lawler's head. He really was pure entertainment, pure carny bullshit. He actually wasn't terrible in the ring. He was quite technically a decent wrestler. But the gimmick is just pure carny bullshit, and it's pure fun. And it's worth going back. His last match, actually, he did obviously go on to become essentially a jobber. He never won a title in the WWF. But the amazing thing is the WWF, WWE, doesn't own exclusively the rights to Doink the Clown. So it's actually tipped up at a number of independent shows down the years. I think as recently as 2012, there's been independent shows with people who have played Doink in the WWF playing Doink again in independent shows and independent promotions, which is awesome. You know, even going back to like Smoky Mountain Wrestling and places like that had Doink the Clown featuring on their cards at times. So he did win titles elsewhere on the indies through the years, but the persona of Doink the Clown never did in the WWF. But his last televised match of him being an official full-time wrestler was in 1995 against the pretty newly arrived from WCW, Hunter Hearst Helmsley. Doink the Clown put over the man who obviously became Triple H, who's now part owner, essentially, of the WWE and running NXT. And that's just, I don't know, there's just something quite amazing that part of Hunter Hearst Helmsley's launch into being a successful entity within the business comes off the back of beating a jobber like Doink the Clown at the time. I don't know, there's just something quite special about that for me. It just kind of shows the carny nature of the WWF. So my mid-carder of the week, just to try and make everyone laugh a little bit more if you go back and watch some of his antics and some of his comedy bullshit, is Doink the Clown.
An excellent choice. My mid-carder of the week, however, is not necessarily a more humorous one, but someone who will keep... he's very fitting for what we're talking about. You know, we're looking for patriots, so to speak. We're also looking for somebody with a decent body of work, not, you know, an absolute lunatic like a Nick Dinsmore, perhaps, who, frankly, I'm never going to pick, especially as Eugene, because fuck that gimmick, particularly with its... issues towards mental health. So I've gone for someone uplifting in a very quiet and respectful manner. He's very much what I think of as a real American in terms of his presentation, the way he carries himself, his modesty, his happiness, and his drive to succeed in whatever he does. And my mid-carder of the week is rather uniquely, Bobby Lashley. The former two-time... Now, the reason I've gone with mid-carder, people say, well, he's not technically a mid-carder because he won the ECW title. He won the ECW world title in that horrific knockoff of ECW. Don't tell me that anything about that was a main event level, because I saw Test in the main event. Fuck you. Also, they made... Well, Jack Swagger was their world champion, amongst other things. But, yeah. Either way, Bobby Lashley, obviously everybody knows him. He still wrestles right now, sadly, for GFW, so it's not really wrestling, is it, if we're being honest? Shut your face, slapnuts! He was actually, for a small part of time, an integral part of what WWE was trying to do. They were trying to build in these bigger guys, but what was great about Bobby Lashley is he was a legitimately world-class amateur wrestler. And the reason I picked him is because of his patriotism. He served in the United States military. He was a United States sergeant. He was also, while during his stint in the United States military, he was also a United States military champion for their what is their form of the Olympics. They have this, it's basically called the International Military Sports Council, and in the CISM Armed Forces Championships in 2003, he won a gold medal in senior freestyle wrestling, and in 2002, he also won two silver medals, one for the Armed Forces Championships and one for the Military World Championships, which, as you can imagine, is quite a big deal in itself. You know, we're talking about the biggest, the best athletes that the military has to offer, and let's be honest, most of these guys are primed and built to be athletes. You'd be amazed just how many world-class boxers, martial artists, athletes, basketball players all serve in the military. These guys are very much at the pinnacle of physical fitness, particularly when it comes to things like the United States Marine Corps. He's got a decorated history, but the ironic thing is, throughout everything he's done, if you take away TNA / GFW achievements, in WWE he had a relatively interesting but short career. He didn't win many titles, and we mentioned that he was a two-time ECW world champion. He was only ever a one-time United States championship holder, and that's kind of what I wanted to look at, was, you know, the fact that he was a United States champion. He had a brief rivalry with John Cena in a losing effort for the world title, but he was very softly spoken, a very quiet guy, but he was a specimen. A lot of people call him Black Lesnar, for better or for worse in that term. I mean, he had all the tools, all the potential. The problem was that he never had the mouthpiece like a Brock Lesnar does with Paul Heyman to help elevate his career. And it's a shame. He was never a talker. He never really portrayed a great deal of charisma. What he did portray was almost like a gentleman's appearance. He was very calm, very polite, very respectful of everybody. You never heard about Bobby Lashley, you know, with heat backstage. I mean, to be honest, who's going to give him shit when you've seen the fucking size of him? But he's very much what I think of as an American. You know, sometimes Americans can be quite boisterous. Sometimes it's warranted, sometimes it's not. Bobby Lashley is head down, hard graft American. He's blue collar. You know, he comes from a working background. You know, he's still, I know for a fact that he still goes to his local barbershop in Colorado. You know, he's still a man of the people, so to speak. He's never lost touch of his roots. That, for me, is what being any working class hero, but also an American working class hero, is all about. It doesn't matter how far you ascend in the world. You know, he's participated for Bellator and MMA. He's actually a well-trained and reasonably dangerous MMA fighter in his own right. So this is a man who has, for many, many, you know, he's, for years, he has learned many crafts, not just the one. Bobby Lashley's highlights in WWE, to be fair, he was one of the few guys who helped legitimize a pretty awful ECW brand when they reincarnated what was, frankly, a pile of shit. And maybe the pinnacle for him was being... Unfortunately for Bobby Lashley, I don't really want to mention it because I don't want people to have a downer on him, but he was, of course, the guy who represented Donald Trump at WrestleMania against Vince McMahon's guy Umaga, and of course won the match in which Vince McMahon's head was shaved bald. So there is this infamous soundbite of Donald Trump going, "Bobby Lashley, folks, that's my man." It's like, God. And I'm sure Bobby Lashley, looking back at it now, is probably just thrilled about the fact that he got to be associated with such a toupee-wearing nonce like fucking Donald Trump. But nonetheless, he was a world-class wrestler. All of his matches were great. I remember he had a wonderful unknown match with Chris Benoit from the Raw in 2005 when they did the brand extension when they went for another draft. And he had this wonderful match on Raw. The idea was that, actually, it was 2006, excuse me. And the idea was that Raw, SmackDown, and ECW would have a draft, much like they did last year for SmackDown Live and Raw. And you had to wrestle. And the winner of that match would win a pick for their team. And Bobby Lashley took on Chris Benoit in what was one of the more technically sound matches I've watched for many, many a year, actually. It was a testament to the fact that Bobby Lashley was not just this big powerhouse who could bench press people, which is what they tried to make him look like. He was also an accomplished grappler. You know, he really got down and dirty on the mat with Chris Benoit. You know, they were toiling for position. And you can see these are two men that were highly trained in the art of being wrestlers. So my mid-carder of the week is a former United States military world champion in freestyle wrestling, Bobby Lashley.
That's an absolutely awesome pick, actually. I liked Bobby Lashley. He had obviously no charisma, really, but
no.
He was awesome in the ring. I did like watching Bobby Lashley. We should wrap things up by doing our matches of the week. And I guess, as per, I shall go first. So, I have gone with something to somewhat lift the spirits. So, I have gone for the first time that Mick Foley won a world title in a long and illustrious career. Mankind versus The Rock on the January the 4th edition in 1999 of Raw is War. You can go back and watch it on the network. So this was a pre-taped show. So this was not broadcast or televised live. And this is such a famous moment for so many reasons. And honestly, I was watching it again a couple of days ago and it still gives me goosebumps now. And for so many reasons. And the drama building up to this, the fact that Mankind and The Rock had this long-storied rivalry and long-storied history. This was before we'd seen the Rock and Sock connection. It had a lot of matches, and some of them had been reasonably brutal and built to more brutal matches through that period. And Mankind had obviously given so much to professional wrestling as Mick Foley, as Cactus Jack over the years. He was already king of the deathmatch. He was already someone who we'd seen all three faces of Foley at different points in the WWF. We'd seen him as Mankind, seen him as Cactus Jack, seen him as Dude Love. This was after the Hell in a Cell at King of the Ring the year before with The Undertaker. But the drama building up to this is the corporation and Vince dominating everything. The Rock is a heel. He is the corporate champion, not the people's champion anymore. He is corporate champion, fully heel Rock. With Vince McMahon, you know, more than just in his corner, overseeing everything. And Mankind had been sort of with the union and all these misfits and represented the outsider. He didn't look like a guy who should be champion. Very reminiscent of things that we heard said by Triple H and Stephanie about guys like Daniel Bryan and CM Punk in more recent years. He didn't look like a champion. He didn't have the face to be the main guy of a company. And this was something that had stalked Mick Foley throughout his entire wrestling career all around the world. You're not talented enough and you don't look like a champion. You're hairy, you're chubby, you know, you've got long, curly black hair, you've got a beard, you're not a beautiful man, you've got half an ear, you're battle scarred. And this was his Mankind, you know, this deranged but increasingly entertaining and amusing character, you know, who had previously been part of the corporation himself before they turned their back on him and he turned their back on them. So he's still coming out in his kind of ex-corporation outfit, you know, this tatty shirt and tie and trousers that Mankind was kind of probably most famed for in recent years. You know, he was behind a mask. How many masked champions have there been in the history of the WWF? Very few. And the drama as this match unfolds, you know, Shane McMahon's the special guest referee and Vince is at ringside. And then we get DX come out. You know, the super cool, sexy faction of DX to have Mankind's back. You know, Triple H, pre-roids, with Road Dogg and Billy Gunn. An X-Pac, I think, is there as well. And you've got kind of Boss Man and Shamrock and Kane of the corporation. It's almost like a lumberjack match in a lot of ways with them, you know. So it looks like Mankind's going to pick up the win against all the odds. Mr. Socko's out. He locks on the mandible claw on the Rock. The Rock looks down. Shamrock comes into the ring, takes out Mankind with a steel chair. DX jumps Shamrock. Everyone piles in. Bossman piles in. Both The Rock and Mankind are down in the middle of the ring. And the glass breaks. The crowd, by the way, throughout this match, if you're going to watch any match for just the ferocity of a crowd, this isn't the panto stuff that we get now. Boo, cheer. This was just rabid desperation from the fans who are watching this live in the arena to see Mankind win the title for the first time, to see the corporation get beaten, to see the biggest heel in the company, Mr. McMahon, have one in the eye, and his hand-selected champion, The Rock, who the fans hated with a passion, to lose and for the title to change hands. The glass breaks, and down comes the hottest superstar ever, as we were saying a couple of weeks ago on Man It Monday, Stone Cold Steve Austin, rampaging his way down, twats The Rock in the face with a steel chair as he tries to get to his feet. Mick Foley crawls over, just drapes his arm over, 1, 2, 3, we've got a new world champion. And there are a few reasons to watch this match. One, as I've said, is the crowd. You have very rarely heard a hotter crowd in your life than this one, and you cannot help but join them and be on the edge of your seat and marking out. Especially where that glass breaks, that reception for Stone Cold Steve Austin is just incredible. It feels like the roof's going to come off. The second reason is obviously the history of it, to see such a deserving winner. And the commentary is done by Jerry the King Lawler and Michael Cole. JR isn't on the show. He's away. I think he's ill at this point. So Michael Cole's standing in for him. Still quite early in Michael Cole's career, especially when you see where he is now. This is when Michael Cole's commentary was something that you really wanted to listen to. He wasn't in the analyst's kind of position that he is now, trying to be the serious journalist commentator. Commentators were characters back then. JR was a character, was a gimmick. And Michael Cole had to be the babyface of the relationship between him and the heel, Jerry Lawler. And the emotion, you know, his voice is cracking as he's like just shouting, Mick Foley has done it, from sleeping in the back of his car just so that he could train to be a wrestler, to getting to the top of the business when people said he couldn't. They used to call him Moby Mick as they beat him as a pudgy kid at school, and he's champion of the world, and you can't help but be all over it. DX carrying Mick Foley around on their shoulders, Road Dogg announcing him in his kind of, you know, WWE champion of the world for Mick Foley, and it's just everyone celebrating. It's a party atmosphere. But one of the other reasons to watch this is, and one of the other reasons why this is so historic, is the reaction from WCW. And this is one of the real definitive moments that saw them plunge in flames out of business over the course of the next couple of years. So they'd got into a habit, and Eric Bischoff is the guy that started this, by saying, we will have plants in the WWF audience at their taped shows, so we know what happens. So we can just announce the results during Nitro ahead of time, so we can say to people, there's no point switching over to our competition. This is what happens. You know what happens now. You don't need to watch it. So Tony Schiavone, obviously the legendary WCW commentator, announces just to let you know, don't bother turning over to our competition. Mick Foley's going to win the title tonight. He's going to be champion. He used to wrestle here as Cactus Jack, and now he's going to win the title. So he says that twice. And after the second time he says that, he says, yeah, he is who's going to be their champion. Everyone turned over to see this moment. And that disrespectful dismissing of Mick Foley and his career, what he gave to WCW in a very long run there as Cactus Jack, where he was powerbombed on concrete, where he lost his ear, was just summarily dismissed by the voice of WCW to the world. And people turned off. They turned over to watch this incredible and historic match, incredible and historic moment, and they didn't turn back to WCW. And that was the problem. It was one of those real turning points in the Monday Night Wars. And it was, I loved it. It is brilliant. I'm a huge Mick Foley mark, and I'm a huge mark for all those guys who were involved, you know, The Rock and Vince and Stone Cold. It was just the absolute perfect amalgamation of drama. Now you'd be sitting there saying, if they threw that away on a Raw or on a SmackDown, it's ridiculous. That's something that should happen on a pay-per-view. But you had to do that in the Monday Night Wars to try and one-up your competition. And the fact that it was given away by WCW, and it's just, it sums up their idiocy as well. So my match of the week, January the 4th, 1999's Monday Night Raw, Mick Foley, Mankind versus The Rock for the WWF title.
A wonderful pick. One of my greatest memories of youth is seeing Mick Foley win the title for the first time and just crying as he's running around the ring and he's telling everybody that McDaddy-O did it, and he's talking to his two kids who are at home, and just absolutely amazing, you know. And hearing him speak back about it as well on the Monday Night Wars documentary, talking about how he had the chance to sit down with his kids and his sons running around the room with the actual WWF heavyweight title that he won from The Rock. And then, you know, he was felt so sore and so disappointed when he watched WCW, because he watched both products when he got home, to see WCW take a big steaming shit on his greatest achievement. But then for him to find out that because of that, it was one of the biggest turning points for WWF in the war against WCW. And of course, the immediate spike in ratings that it caused and essentially propelled Raw over WCW and Monday Nitro. You know, it's, I think for him looking back, it's probably one of his most proudest moments. And it should be. It was an incredible achievement in a time where WWF champions were not, as you say, chubby, bearded monstrosities. And for someone like myself, who wasn't the prettiest guy in the world and looked a bit scruffy, liked facial hair, was quite a hairy guy, a big guy, that was awesome. That proved to me that not necessarily just in wrestling, but in life, you can still achieve great things. You don't have to look like the epitome of perfection. Hard work, graft, effort, and belief will take you to a certain level, if not to the pinnacle, if you truly want it. So a fine pick, sir, a fine pick.
Oh, yes.
In keeping with my subtle but emotional value that I went with, in keeping with the sort of the Bobby Lashley style of mid-card pick, my match of the week is something very powerfully emotional, something very important to me. And it happened in 2003 at the grandest stage of them all, WrestleMania 19. There was a plethora of great matches on this card. This is regarded as one of the best ever wrestling WrestleManias, along with 21 and 17, obviously. 17 is considered a pinnacle. This is remembered as one of those WrestleManias where, you know, you had Kurt Angle versus Brock Lesnar for the title. You had this incredible collision between Chris Jericho and Shawn Michaels. You had Los Guerreros wrestling Chris Benoit or Rhino. You had Los Guerreros. You know, you had the Edge and Rey Mysterio value of things. You know, you had Rey Mysterio versus Matt Hardy for the Cruiserweight title. RVD and Kane defending tag team titles. There were some great matches overall. Booker T versus Triple H, obviously. But the match I've gone with is the final match in the incredible saga, for me, the greatest rivalry in wrestling history, and it is Austin versus The Rock 3 at WrestleMania 19. It is, for me, the perfect ending to a wrestling career. Austin had obviously returned. He had not long returned after his hiatus. He'd walked out on the company over creative disagreements. They were looking to book him versus Brock Lesnar on a Monday Night Raw, which when you think about it now is utterly obscene. I can understand his viewpoint. He still to this day, however, says it is the greatest regret and the greatest mistake he made in his wrestling career to walk out of the company. He obviously took a huge fine. He was punished, but he was brought back, and at No Way Out, he returned to beat the living shit out of Eric Bischoff. Yeah, but this by this point, we knew that Austin just wasn't really there to go anymore. He just couldn't go anymore. The injuries had taken their toll. This was his final hurrah. And the interesting fact is, and I'm sure a lot of people already know this, but just in case there is the odd person who doesn't realize, Austin actually suffered a massive health scare the night before WrestleMania. It was in Seattle, and the night before he suffered a huge health scare and was taken in a hospital. A combination of coffee and energy drinks and just these general stress had led to essentially heart palpitations. I'm not entirely sure what the actual medical condition was, but he'd collapsed, he'd had an episode, and they'd basically said, look, you need to be very, very careful. Austin knew that it was his last match going into this match with The Rock, but very few people knew, other than, of course, the most obvious people, possibly The Rock, possibly Vince McMahon, but very, very few others. And for Austin, he was scared. He was scared. You know, you watched the documentary, but you could see there's a slight trepidation in his eyes of, you know, is this, I just want to make it out of there alive. But at the same time, as the ever professional that he was, he wanted to create one lasting memory for people. And this match is incredible because very rarely in a collision between The Rock and Stone Cold is there, quite frankly, very little to no love for The Rock. Even in the most heel of personas, he would still garner a certain degree of attraction from the crowd. But it was always Austin. At WrestleMania 15, it was Austin. At WrestleMania 17, it was definitely Austin, you know, in Texas, for the love of God. This was it. This was the collision. And the build-up to this match is incredible. They use Limp Bizkit's Crack Addict, which is one of my favorite all-time songs, for a video promo right after the My Way. I like the fact that they kept the almost the tradition that was Limp Bizkit as the soundtrack for these two guys. Obviously, WrestleMania 17 is regarded as, you know, one of the greatest pieces of video work ever in that My Way promo. And this is very close to that. The beautiful, beautiful work that both guys did. The way that The Rock came out on that Raw a few weeks before and he said the one thing The Rock has not done is whooped that ball candy ass at WrestleMania. You know, the fact that The Rock has done it all, but I haven't beaten you where it matters most. I've beaten you at Survivor Series 2001. You know, I've beaten you in tag matches and things like that, but I've never done it at the big stage. It's always been you. It's always been you. And Austin is the perfect for these two are the ultimate collision. The ultimate superheroes. They are the ultimate battle, so to speak. You know, when you watch things like Marvel now, for me, Austin and The Rock and the magnitude of it eclipses everything that is, you know, fictional storylines like Marvel collisions, you know, like the Hulk and Captain America and things like that. This, for me, is the most iconic collision I've ever seen in my life on any platform or any medium. And the match itself, it's not the perfect wrestling match, but it's the energy and the emotion that it portrays. It's the fact that The Rock can't keep him down. You know, he's desperately trying to keep Austin down. Austin just keeps coming back. This is an amazing moment in the match as well. They're telling this incredible story. The Rock, the audacity of it to grab Austin's leather jacket and to start mocking him incessantly, doing shitty two fingers and shaking his head. And he stunners Stone Cold Steve Austin, keeping in line with their incredible rivalry, which saw them over the years constantly stealing each other's finisher. The Rock hits him with a stunner. He won't stay down. Austin retaliates, hits him with a rock bottom. But this was very much a pay-per-view of the three finishers. It took three F5s to keep down Kurt Angle. It took I can't remember what other matches there were, but there were a lot of matches where essentially they'd use free finishes to keep people down. I think that Chris Jericho had taken free super kicks. You know, there was all this kind of... There was this weird kind of symmetry. Numbers seem to be an interesting facet here. And in this match, The Rock has to hit the Rock Bottom three times. And I remember the third one. And Austin says in the documentary, this was it. This was my final bump. And you can tell because he goes for it. I don't think I've ever seen a more ferociously impactful Rock Bottom in my entire life. Not on the ring canvas. You know, he put Triple H for a table once on a Raw after Judgment Day 2000. But nobody ever hit the mat. That was incredible as well. I think it was that King of the Ring 2000 when he did that.
Yeah.
It's just awesome. But this was just a raw, powerful... This is very much like the Shawn Michaels, Ric Flair moment, where he says, I'm sorry, I love you, and he super kicks him, and he puts him down for his career. And to see the rock bottom, and as you know, everybody knows, but some people might, of course... When he rock bottoms him and he finally pins him 1-2-3, he actually holds Austin's hand. There's this beautiful moment. You can see him holding his hand. And, you know, the referee comes over and he's like, you get your fucking ass out of here. And he just shoves the referee away and he whispers to Austin, thank you for everything you did for me to make me the guy I am today. I love you. And it's these two are just perfection to me. They are the perfect, perfect storytelling. You know, almost like a... It's kind of weird, like, you see great pairings in TV and film. You know, you got to see, like, Rick and Shane, for instance, in The Walking Dead, the way they would contrast each other, but yet they were still brothers. And that was what these two did better than anyone else. I'm yet to see in this day and age, and before that as well, I have never seen storytelling that has culminated so beautifully between two people. These two men... At one point, were all the WWF really had, you know, especially when The Undertaker was out injured. These two helped catapult a company that truly was struggling and was dying in the face of WCW's dominance and their money. But they always had the better product. They always believed that. And these two were at the forefront of that. And to see The Rock put down Austin at WrestleMania and to know that Austin had, for me, the perfect ending as a wrestler. Austin would return as GM, you know, special appearances, even as a guest referee at future WrestleManias. But he would never, ever wrestle again. And he's often said, I will never have a match again. And he had the perfect ending to a wrestling career. Ric Flair had an incredible ending. But he then tarnished it by running off to TNA and then coming back and having these kind of carny guest appearance matches. For Austin, that was it. That's the last true bump I ever saw him take as a proper wrestler. I think I remember Kane chokeslammed him a couple of times during his era as GM, but this was it. This was the pinnacle of what was, in fact, an actual very short time on top. Austin, in the entirety of his career in WWF, really only was on top for 4 to 5 years maximum. And even then, a lot of that time, he was missing or injured or wasn't able to compete. So truly, you only had 2 to 3 years of actual in-ring world-class Stone Cold Steve Austin at the top. And this was it for him. And for me, it's the most, still to this day, one of the most emotional matches I've ever seen. I can watch it over and over. It's tragic, but it's also beautiful. And there's this amazing camera angle as the camera follows Stone Cold Steve Austin out. And you see what he sees as he strides down to the ring with his bad motherfucker walk, as he likes to say. And there's the crowd, you know, 60, 70,000 people. The lights are going crazy. And the entire world, it seems, is watching Stone Cold, the great man that he was, the Rattlesnake, make his final bow as a wrestler. It's utterly incredible. It's if people ask me all the time, what's the one show you could have been in person for? It would have been that. I would have killed to have been there for that more than, even more so than WrestleMania 17, because for me, it was that time to say goodbye and to say thank you to one of the greatest icons in all of entertainment, period. So my match of the week is WrestleMania 19's Incredible Collision, the third part of the Ultimate Trilogy that was Austin versus The Rock at WrestleMania.
Yeah, it's an absolutely phenomenal choice. It really is, I think, the best and most definitive rivalry in the history of the WWE and, well, professional wrestling, really. You know, it had
a magic, didn't it? An indefinable magic. If you could put that in a bottle and use that repeatedly, it would be incredible. And it's one of those that maybe fans of the current product will be sitting there saying, is it a bit like Cena and Roman Reigns? No. That's what Vince is hoping for. You know, that's as close as maybe you're going to get in the current product is going to be that. Your two biggest, you know, icons or standard bearers of the company. But these guys were on an entire another level when it came to crossover appeal, when it came to popularity, at a time when the product was at its hottest across the board, no matter what company you're working for. Professional wrestling was just so over. It was so popular with so many people. And these were the two pinnacle guys who led the way in the industry and in the business. You know, guys like Sting and guys like Kevin Nash and Scott Hall, they didn't have the kind of mass appeal that The Rock and Stone Cold had and still have, really, when you think about it. So, yeah, just, I mean, we could definitely just do an entire special podcast, and maybe we will one day, of Manic Mondays, just talking about their rivalry through the years, because it really just really was incredible. And if anything encapsulated that era, it was that rivalry. That's the one that we all remember, and that's the one that we all talk about, especially in terms of wrestling content, because obviously, as we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Austin versus Vince was very definitive, but nothing quite got your goosebumps going like that moment when the music hit for those two guys and you just knew the house was about to be torn the fuck down. It was just, yeah, incredible.
We've been holding back on it, haven't we, really? We haven't involved it in our Manic Monday polls yet. With good reason, I feel like, to be honest, for me and Steve, like, the pinnacle of our wrestling childhoods is Austin versus The Rock. And even in our teenage, you know, elder teenage years, you know, it's a case of, I mean, I was 18 when it finally wrapped itself up. I don't know. It's a weird one to explain. But I think, you know, obviously, the feedback is important to us. You know, this really is hashtag for the fans. So you'll let us know when the time is right, when you truly want the Austin versus Rock podcast, because that will be essentially the pinnacle for us of Manic Monday. So whether it comes soon or whether it comes many, many months down the line, we don't know, but rest assured it will be there. But I think it would probably be, I don't know, you'd probably be in agreement with me, it'd probably be better to dedicate an entire podcast to the overall encompassing rivalry as opposed to breaking it down and just having each match over different podcasts and discussing it. I think it's one of those things that the magnitude of it is so high, it would be important to make sure the entire time is dedicated to it.
Yeah, I don't think we can just do like a 15 or 20 minute segment on Austin versus The Rock, because you just cannot cover it. You could sit there and talk in stats and numbers and the chronology, but to really convey the emotion and what it meant to us as wrestling fans of the product at that time and what it still means to us now, how it stayed with us. Because as much as there are a lot of other rivalries, of course, that we've absolutely loved and adored, I don't think any has stayed with us, you know, emotionally to the same extent as Austin Rock. Like, that's just, you know, above and beyond. As I said, I think it's the pinnacle of the business in any era. You know, people will talk about, you know, the iconic moments of Hogan and, you know, facing off with Andre the Giant, and people will talk about, you know, well, how important Mick Foley was for The Undertaker's career, or The Undertaker-Kane showdowns over the years. People talk about The Rock and Triple H had phenomenal rivalries, maybe some rivalries in the tag division, maybe rivalries more up to date, you know, Daniel Bryan going against the Authority. You know, Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart, incredible rivalries, all of them, and all very emotionally impactful. But I don't think anything, you know, for me and you and for a lot of wrestling fans who grew up in the Attitude Era, I don't think anything in and out of the ring was as brilliant or as important, you know, in helping to almost fashion us as people in so many ways, as Austin and The Rock, the two biggest icons, certainly of their era and of any era. You know, if either one of those two come back, you know, just to do a guest appearance, it's the best thing of the year. It's the best segment, the best promos of the year, guaranteed, because, you know, the talent and the charisma they have is just immortal, and the popularity and connection they have is just undying with the audience. So yeah, we can't just throw it away on something. I'm sure we'll keep mentioning matches and segments of their rivalry, but we do need to dedicate an entire podcast at some point.
Yes, we do. I think it's an ideal place to take it home, good Steve.
Yeah, well, thanks everyone, obviously, for listening to the show. Keep your eyes out for more polls that will be coming up so that you can decide what we talk about on the next podcast. Apologies for the fact that I've been away, so you couldn't dictate this one too much. I'm sure there will be some other specials coming up. Let us know, give us some feedback, what you think about us doing a special. And I know we've kind of picked it this time because there wasn't the opportunity to throw it out to you guys. But if that's something that you've enjoyed, then let us know. It's a slightly different format. We're always experimenting and tweaking. Obviously, keep your eyes out as well for our Week in the Universe podcasts. Part one, dealing with the shenanigans of SmackDown and Raw. And part two, looking at NXT and 205 Live. You can also keep an eye out for Indie 50 podcast, which will be dropping as independent wrestling keeps going. And there'll be we'll be talking as well about the goings-on in the Mae Young Classic, as we look at bringing in new talent in the women's division for the WWE, as some of the best independent competitors come together on the WWE network. You can follow us on the Twitter at the Smark Plug on Twitter. Search for us on there and give us a follow. You can also search for the Smark Plug on Facebook, where we'll be updating videos and such of our matches of the week, maybe some of our mid-carder of the week highlights as well. I'm sure we'll try and put up maybe Lillian Garcia's rendition of the national anthem from the September the 11th tribute SmackDown onto our Facebook this week. You can also find us on YouTube. The Smart Plug podcast is on YouTube as well, if it's a little bit easier for you to listen to our content via that medium, feel free. My personal Twitter is at SteveTheDuke87. Feel free to hit me up for a chat about football, music or wrestling, of course. Thanks very much for listening. I'll let Amir close it down.
Thank you very much, sir. It has been quite an awesome episode of Manic Mondays, as always. Obviously, my personal Twitter account is at Dunham Devil, D-U-N-H-O-L-M-E, Devil, if you want to get at me for anything more personal. But as Steve has said, the best channels are obviously on the Twitter. We obviously also have the Facebook. Of course, as he mentioned, we're constantly uploading it with videos and stuff. So please get in discussion with the comments underneath. We've had a little bit of an uptake in people chatting on there. It'd be lovely to know what you think, and obviously just give us your general opinions on, you know, our matches of the week, our mid-carders of the week, and just our general content. It's lovely to have discussion across all platforms. Of course, you can find us on iTunes and Podbean. You can leave us comments, likes, and anything you have of interest actually on the Podbean website. It's free to sign up. Don't worry about any kind of subscription fees or anything. Very quick, simple sign up, and that will give you a much quicker and direct access to us if you care to listen to us via the website without having to worry about all the nonsense that comes with downloading apps and whatnot. But if you're listening to us on iTunes, please give us a review. We're yet to get any reviews on iTunes, but obviously, if you could give us reviews, obviously be honest, you know, we're not asking for 5 stars, tell us what you really think. But any reviews that are positive are obviously going to help us out in pushing this, you know, this product out there and, you know, making it more viable on iTunes for people to listen to. And obviously, the more people that listen, the more interaction we can get. And obviously, most importantly, we can produce as best a quality podcast as we can for you guys, because the reality is these podcasts are hashtag for the fans. So it gives me great pleasure to say that I have been your host, Amir Azaneni, and thank you very much to my co-host and an integral part of everything we do here at Smart Plug, Steve Neal.
Thank you very much, and we'll see you guys down the road.
Yes, we will, ladies and gentlemen. We will see you very soon down the road for another podcast from the Smart Plug Podcast Network. Take care of each other, love each other as always, and just be safe out there and enjoy your weekends and your bank holidays. Take care, gang.
Well, folks, we're all out of time. This is Johnny Gomez saying good fight, good night.